Well, let's go before the Lord in prayer, and we will dig in. Father, I come before you. I thank you for your goodness and for the opportunity to study your word together. I pray, Father, Lord, for your strength in the time that follows. Give us clarity of, give me clarity of speech, and give those present clarity to hear. And may you be glorified in all we do and say. In Jesus' name, I pray. Amen. So after a brief prologue, Exodus divides into two parallel panels. So you have a prologue in verses 1 through 7 of chapter 1. And then you have the first panel. The Lord delivers Israel from service to Pharaoh. And they were building store cities for Pharaoh, and God delivers them from that. That's found in chapter 1 through chapter 13. And then you have the second parallel panel, that the Lord enables Israel to serve him and to build the tabernacle. Each of these panels can be divided into five sections. Several weeks ago, we discussed the structure of Exodus, and then continued on with a discussion of the prologue. Tonight, by God's grace, and I've been told that this is not possible, but I'm going to try to cover the whole first section from 1:8 through the end of chapter 2. And so one of the things I'd like to do with this is to do more survey mode, where I'm not talking about everything that could be talked about. It's very hard for me. But I think since we're going in such detail on Sunday morning, it would be good to move at a bit of a faster clip on Sunday night when we're teaching through books of the Bible so that we can cover some larger sections of Scripture. And so this first section of the first panel tells the story of how Moses was delivered through water, driven into the wilderness, and brought to the mountain of God, and sets up the contest between Pharaoh, who does not know Joseph, and God, who does know the suffering of his people. And so this first section of the first panel deals with the Pharaoh who doesn't know, and how he sets himself against the God who does know. So it's setting up the contrast. Pharaoh doesn't choose to know. God chooses to know. And it's setting up the contest between the two of them. And so the first first paragraph here, Exodus 1 in verse 8. Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. And it's very important that this new king is not mentioned. His name is not given. Pharaoh is a title, not a name. And this is a form of contempt practiced by the pharaohs against their enemies, that they would erase people's names. They would not mention them. And so we're going to find that the Hebrew midwives, the lowly slaves, their names are given, but the mighty Pharaoh, his name has been forgotten. And it's not that this Pharaoh is not aware of Joseph. He chooses not to know. He chooses not to remember. And we're going to find at the end, there's a significant parallel to this. Verse 9, and he said unto his people, behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Now, Pharaoh is certainly exaggerating. If this had actually been true, his policy would have not worked at all. It would have been completely ineffective. So he's exaggerating the problem. That's the first thing he does. And the second thing he does, now Pharaoh is an absolute monarch, right? He rules over his people as if they were slaves. But notice that Pharaoh says, they're more and mightier than we. He's like, hey, Egyptians, you and me, we are on the same team. I feel your pain. And you know who's responsible for that pain? It's those horrible Israelites. We need to do something about that. This is the language of political manipulation in every age. When people claim to feel your pain, double check their motivations and keep your hand tight on your wallet. The Egyptians fell, though, for Pharaoh's flattery, and they became willing participants in the oppression of the Israelites, just as later they would become the unwilling recipients of the judgment that the oppression would bring. You wonder, why did the Egyptians, not just Pharaoh, but the Egyptians suffer so much? Well, it wasn't just Pharaoh who imposed the oppression. It was the Egyptians who bought into his lies and participated right along with him, and they would suffer judgment along with him. So having exaggerated the danger and pretended to identify with the common Egyptian, this nameless Pharaoh is now ready to propose a wise solution. Come on, let's deal wisely with them, Pharaoh says. Now, as we'll see more clearly in a minute, The language used for Pharaoh's building project deliberately alludes to the story of the Tower of Babel, just as the language used for God's building project, the tabernacle, deliberately alludes to the Garden of Eden. Pharaoh's store cities are built by the wisdom of this world, and God's tabernacle is built by the wisdom that comes from above. So we have two competing building projects, and we have two competing sources of wisdom. We're going to see who's going to come out on top. Second part of verse 10, lest they multiply, and it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. So make no mistake about it. Pharaoh is setting himself in direct opposition to God's creational purposes for the sons of Israel. So God's purposes for his people was that they would multiply and they would come up out of the land. That was what God had promised to Abraham, that in fulfillment of the original creational covenant, Israel would multiply and Israel would come back to the land. And Pharaoh says, let's stop him from multiplying and let's stop him from going up out of the land. He's setting himself directly athwart God's purposes. This is not going to end well for Pharaoh. Verse 11. Therefore, they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Pithom and Ramses. Now, the phrase that's translated as treasure cities is more likely to be translated as store cities or perhaps garrison cities. In Hebrew, this phrase is Ari Miskanot. Now, the ot ending in Hebrew is simply makes the word plural. It's like adding an S in English. In Hebrew, the word that is translated as tabernacle is Mishkan. So you have Miskanot that Pharaoh is building and a Mishkan that God is building. As so often in the Hebrew Old Testament, what may seem to us like a mere wordplay is deadly serious and of central importance. So the central theme of the book of Exodus is how the sons of Israel went from serving Pharaoh by building Miskanot to serving the Lord by building a Mishkan. The central theme of the book of Exodus is, in many ways, a tale of two building projects, a tale that contrasts the rebellious human desire to build Babel in every age with God's covenantal promise to restore the garden sanctuary of Eden. And Eden, if you understand Eden aright, is actually, it's not like a paradise out in the wilderness somewhere. No, in the ancient Near East, gardens were associated with cities, and more particularly with temples. Eden is a temple city garden, and the tabernacle is a way of getting back to Eden, and Pharaoh's cities are a way of getting back to Babel. And so the central story of Exodus is the building of Babel versus a return to Eden. And that's underscored even at the way those two words sound, store cities and tabernacles. Tabernacle. Verse 12. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were grieved because of the children of Israel. Pharaoh was not as wise as he thought, and therefore his plan backfired royally. The only royal thing about Pharaoh's plan was how badly it backfired. And the word translated as grieved more likely refers to terror or fear rather than sorrow. They weren't sad. They were terrified, as the ESV puts it, and the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. The failure of Pharaoh's plan terrified those who had foolishly put their faith in him. So Pharaoh got them on his side, but Pharaoh's plan backfired, and now they are frightened. They're terrified. Yet rather than repenting of their wickedness, they instead double down on it. Because that's what tyrants do. Verse 13. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve. Listen to all the words that refer to service. To serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar and in brick. And in all manner of service in the field, all their service when they made them serve was with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar and in brick. And in all manner of service in the field, all their... I have that verse twice. Verses 13 through 14. So skip the second reading of verse 14. Now, there's two important things here. First, the word translated as serve or service, the noun and the verb, that is a key word in the book of Exodus. And it closely connects the two building projects I mentioned earlier. So at the beginning of Exodus, Israel is serving Pharaoh by building store cities for him. But when God comes to Pharaoh, he doesn't demand that Israel stop serving, but that Israel serve him instead. Exodus 4:22. Thou shalt say unto Pharaoh, thus saith the Lord, Israel is my son, even my firstborn. And I say unto thee, let my son go, that he may do what? That he may serve me. And if thou refuse to let him go, behold, I will slay thy son, even thy firstborn. So this demand that my son or my people may serve me is repeated no less than 7 times in the book of Exodus. In many ways, it is what the Exodus is about. In the first half, the first panel, the question is, whose servant is Israel going to be? Whose son is Israel going to be? Are they going to serve Pharaoh or are they going to serve God? That's the question in the first panel. In the second half of the book, the question is, how is Israel going to serve? Or perhaps, what kind of son is Israel going to be? They've been rescued from Egypt. They've been declared to be God's son. What kind of son is Israel going to be? And what is that service going to look like? That's the question that's addressed in the second half. The other thing that's interesting, though we didn't go into all the details, is there are a number of subtle allusions, even in the very grammar, throughout this account to another building project, a building project we find in Genesis. We find what is perhaps the most striking of these allusions with the reference to mortar and brick in verse 14. Where else do you find mortar and brick in the Bible? There's only one other passage in the whole Old Testament that uses these two Hebrew words. And does anyone have an idea of what that passage might be? I've already hinted at it. Philemon? Tower of Babel is the only other building project that involves mortar and brick. Genesis 11:3. And they said to one another, go to, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and slime had they for mortar. And there's a number of other connections we won't take the time to go into, but the account of Pharaoh's store cities is being pictured as a new Babel. That does not bode well for Pharaoh's building project. The multiple allusions between the two accounts make it clear that we are intended to read the story of Pharaoh in light of the story of the Tower of Babel. Just as the builders of the city and the tower had set themselves against the creational plans and purposes of God, God said to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth, and they said, no, we're going to stay and we're going to make a name for ourselves here in Babel. So they set themselves against God, and now Pharaoh is setting himself against God's creational purposes. And this birth control through hard labor was Pharaoh's first plan. And so we've covered that. What might be some of the anti-creational building projects of our own day? How might people be setting themselves against God's creational purposes in our own society? Brother Tanaka? Abortion? Anyone else? That's a good one. What are some of the anti-creational building projects of our own society? I think one of the most striking ones that I see is the idea to erase the difference between men and women. And so one of the key battle lines that we face in our own day is transgenderism. The next book of the month is going to be dealing with some of this gender ideology that God created them male and female. And our society wants to erase the difference between male and female and is maximally invested in erasing that distinction. And in that task, they are setting themselves directly against the creational purposes of God. And it's not going to end any better for them than Pharaoh's store cities ended for him. Now let's move on to the second paragraph. So we had round one, verses 8 through 14. Pharaoh attempts to control them through hard labor. And since his first plan failed miserably, the Pharaoh tries a different tactic. Verse 15. And the king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives, of which the name of the one was Shipra, and the name of the other Puah. And once again, it's very significant to notice the midwives are named and the Pharaoh is not. And though only two midwives are listed here, there likely would have been many midwives. It's the first midwife and the second midwife. Presumably there were some more than that. Verse 16, and he said, when you do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew women and see them upon the stools, if it be a son, then ye shall kill him. But if it be a daughter, then she shall live. So Pharaoh doesn't care about the daughters. He's worried about the sons. He doesn't think the daughters pose a threat. He thinks the sons pose a threat. And we're going to find that this backfires royally on Pharaoh. And so one of the things, if you haven't got the hint yet, this is supposed to be funny. We're supposed to be laughing at Pharaoh's foolishness. And it's ironic. Now, it's very serious as well, but a very serious theological point and humor in the Old Testament, and indeed in reality, go very well together. This account is subtly poking fun at Pharaoh, who thinks he's so wise, but is in fact so foolish. So his plan shifts from population control by overwork to population control through partial birth abortion. And though he only sees the sons as a threat, it's going to be the daughters that are going to do him in. So the reference to what the King James translates as stools in Hebrew literally is two stones. It's very obscure and it's been much debated. So it could perhaps be a reference to some sort of stone stool on which the mother gave birth, so some sort of birthing stool, or perhaps a euphemism for genitals. It's very hard to know, and it's just very difficult to figure out because this word only occurs like two times in the whole Hebrew Bible, and it's a bit puzzling. Verse 17, but the midwives feared God and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men children alive. Though obedience to government, even governments we do not like, is a real obligation, that obligation is always relative, never absolute. We must always obey God rather than man when the two are in conflict. At the same time, we should make sure it's God that we're actually obeying. Disobedience to man is not necessarily obedience to God, simply because it's different from what we were told to do. Given the contrast between the pretended wisdom on which Pharaoh's empire is built and the true wisdom given to build the tabernacle, the midwife's fear of the Lord is surely significant. As we see in Proverbs, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. And the midwives begin by fearing the Lord. And so they possess true wisdom. Pharaoh began by forgetting about what God had done for his people, and so he is foolish. He despises wisdom and instruction. So we're going to see the end of this story. Verse 18, and the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said unto them, why have ye done this thing and have saved the men children alive? And the midwives said unto Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are lively and are delivered ere the midwives come in unto them. Now, throughout the centuries, there's been a vast amount of debate about the story the midwives told Pharaoh. And though we cannot explore all the suggestions that have been made, there's a few things to keep in mind. First, the midwife story certainly sounds pretty sketchy. At the same time, we don't actually know for sure that it wasn't the truth. Remember that God was giving supernatural fertility to his people at this time. They weren't just having children. They were having lots and lots of children. They were having a supernatural abundance of children at this particular point in time. If they were having that many children, then surely part of God's miraculous provision would have been much easier deliveries than they might normally have been expected to have, so they could recover faster, so that God could give them more children. So it's quite possible there was something remarkable going on. If they really are multiplying at this incredible rate, then something remarkable would have had to be taken place when the Hebrew women are giving birth. So it's possible that there's more than a grain of truth to what they said to Pharaoh. Secondly, even if the midwife story wasn't true, and it does sound a little sketchy, they are praised not for lying to Pharaoh, but for fearing God. As Augustine long ago put it, if they did tell a lie, this would be an occasion not for praise, but for pardon. So they aren't condemned for what they said, but if they did tell a lie, there's no praise for pulling the wool over Pharaoh's eyes either. In any case, we should remember that we have no grounds to conclude that simply because an action is not explicitly condemned in a particular context, that it is therefore necessarily justified by that context or set forth as an example to emulate. Though Abraham, for example, was praised for his faith in Hebrews, his story is not rightly used to justify marrying one's sister. Abraham was praised for his faith, not for marrying his sister. And so, even if the midwives did tell a lie, their praise for fearing God and saving the children alive, not necessarily for the way in which they accomplished that. In any case, we must always interpret doubtful examples by clear instruction, and Ephesians 4:25 is about as clear as it gets. Wherefore, putting away lying, speak every man truth with his neighbor. Therefore, God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied, verse 20, and waxed very mighty. And it came to pass, because the midwives feared God, that he made them houses. We see, and not for the last time, that Pharaoh's pretended wisdom is foiled by the daughters that he didn't see as a threat. And it's very interesting, one of the things you see, particularly in Luke's gospel, you have all this emphasis on women, and Luke is tying back, Matthew ties back to the Exodus story in his own way, but Luke, who places emphasis on Mary and on Elizabeth, it really ties back to this Exodus account that God is raising up the lowly, those that are despised by the world, and God is accomplishing a deliverance through these women, through the daughters, and the parallel between the first two chapters of Exodus and the first two chapters of Luke is intentional in the way that the story is emphasized. The precise meaning is a bit obscure. The reference to houses most likely refers in some way to households, to families, rather than to residences. So for the second time, Pharaoh's attempt to thwart the creational purposes of God for his people has been thwarted itself. It's getting quite a bit of a ring, I'm not sure. Seems really loud up here. What would be some of the areas, so I have a question for you, what would be some of the areas in our own lives where we might be called upon to obey God rather than man? So what would be some situations in our own lives in which the anti-creational agenda of this present age might bring us into conflict, where we might be forced to obey God rather than man, specifically in an area that has to do with one of the ways in which our society has set forth an anti-creational building project? That was a little more wordy than it needed to be, but hopefully it was still clear. So what would be some of the ways that we might be called to say no to one of the anti-creational projects of this present age? Brother Tanaka?
Well, Washington State has physician-assisted suicide as legal, and I've had patients ask me to end their life, and I refuse to and help them reduce pain and suffering to the end, and obeying God is always better than obeying man.
Absolutely. That's a perfect example. Anyone else? Any other examples where we might be called upon? Tyler.
As a leader in a government or a federal position in a supervisory role, refusing to refer to someone who is actually a man as a woman, and just navigating that, whereas you could easily be, called out aggressively and proven guilty by when, just not being able to. Just being required to stick to the gender that God had given them at birth. And you can be called out for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And pay a heavy price for it, depending on the setting. There are settings in which one could lose one's job for refusing to do that. And I think, it's usually appropriate to use whatever name someone decides to call themselves. But when you start using pronouns that are explicitly masculine to refer to someone who is, in fact, a woman, or vice versa, I think then we're being co-opted into an agenda that set itself against God's creational purpose, and we need to not do that. And so that's really sometimes hard to know how to navigate that, and it's something we're going to face more and more and more of. That's a very good example. Anyone else? Sweetheart?
When I was working at CareNet, they were working on legislation. The government was to try to make us present all the options to the women and not give any bias towards any, so adoption, abortion, or keeping the baby. We were supposed to present all of those options, and obviously we didn't.
Yeah, that's another very good one. And this is something like, as our society has anti-creational projects, and we can't support those building projects. We must obey God rather than man. And it's really important to have clear thinking to separate what are the things we are required to do by God, and what are the things that are maybe our opinions and our preferences that we don't like, but it's not sinful to go along with. It's just part of living in a broken society. And it's important to have clear thinking and to talk through some of those situations in advance, beforehand, so that we know what would be a compromise and what would not be a compromise. And that's very important to be thinking about. Any questions about what we've covered up to this point? Any questions you have for me up to this point before we move forward? Philemon.
You referenced Abraham marrying his sister. I've heard a lot of people make a bunch of hay about the fact that the law had yet to be given at that point.
Mm-hmm.
What are you basing your assessment of that off of?
Well, just that every detail of a story isn't necessary. You know, so the law is subsequently given and it's subsequently made plain. That's not something to emulate. So simply because, like, something takes place in a story doesn't mean that's necessarily approved or something. You know, because when Genesis is written, that law had already been given. Well, by the time Genesis is being written, it's being written by Moses, or at least presented by Moses to the people of Israel. So the law had already been given by that point. The story's being told the way it took place, but we're not to emulate every detail. You know, so we're not to emulate Jacob and marrying two wives, and that sort of thing. So you have to take the big picture of Scripture as a whole in order to take ethical guidance. Sometimes we can take bits and pieces from stories that, you know, we're looking for an excuse to do what we want to do, and we can find someone who did that. And that can be a shortcut to get around, you know, considering the whole counsel of Scripture on a particular topic. Did that answer your question? Okay. Anyone else before we move on? All right, moving right along. Pharaoh tried verse 22, the wisdom of Pharaoh, round 3. Pharaoh tried population control through oppression. That didn't work. He tried commanding the midwives to abort the boy babies, and that didn't work. So now that the midwives, the powerless Hebrew midwives, haven't listened to Pharaoh, so Pharaoh's not being obeyed, he decides to command even more people. That's Pharaoh's wisdom. When a few people don't listen to him, give more drastic orders to lots more people and see how that turns out for you. That's Pharaoh's thought. He's not as wise as he thinks he is. Verse 22, and Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, every son that is born ye shall cast into the river, and every daughter ye shall save alive. Evidently, he hasn't figured out yet how the daughters are thwarting his plans. So as we've seen in our series in Matthew, there's a strong parallel between both Herod's slaughter of the infants of Bethlehem and this attempt to slaughter the boys of the Hebrew slaves in Egypt. And also between Pharaoh's chasing Moses out of Egypt, the threat to Moses' life. So you both have a threat to all the boys of Israel, and you have a threat to Moses in particular. And as we've seen in Matthew takes care to echo both of those stories and to tie them together in Matthew. We saw that a few weeks ago. In the text of Exodus itself, the story of Exodus begins with a Pharaoh seeking to cast Israelites into the water, and then the Exodus finishes off with the army of Pharaoh being destroyed by the water. So the punishment fits the crime. Chapter 2 and verse 1. And there went a man of the house of Levi and took to wife a daughter of Levi. And since Moses' siblings, Aaron and Miriam, were older than he was, this marriage must have taken place a few years before. Nevertheless, the story makes clear that God's plan of deliverance took place through the simple continuance of the ordinary pattern of marriage and birth. Oftentimes, the most countercultural thing we can do is to continue being faithful to the normal rhythms of life when it would seem as though the best thing to do would be to uproot all of those rhythms and do something radically different. And so they continued to build a family, even in these very difficult times that they faced. Verse 2, and the woman conceived and bare a son, and when she saw that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. Now in Hebrew, the phrase that is translated as that he was a goodly child, that he was goodly, is literally ketov. Now ketov is the very phrase that's used in Genesis 1, where God says 7 times, he looks at his creation, he saw that it was good, word for word, exactly the phrase, Moses' mother looks at Moses and sees that he is good. In setting himself against God's creational order, Pharaoh is fighting a losing battle because creation always wins. So this language tying Genesis 1 to the birth of Moses is underscoring that the birth of Moses is in support of God's creational agenda, and it also represents a new beginning for God's people. Verse 3, and when she could no longer hide him, perhaps because he got too noisy or because she couldn't just keep him hidden away from the eyes of her neighbors, we don't know for sure, she took for him an ark of bulrushes and daubed it with slime and with pitch and put the child therein, and she laid it in the flags by the river's brink. And his sister stood afar off to wit what would be done to him. And the word that's translated as ark here is only used in the story of Noah. So the Ark of the Covenant uses a totally different Hebrew word. The word for Ark Tipa that is used here is only used in the story of Noah and in the story of Moses. And of course, it's being used in that way to link the two stories together. And there are a number of other allusions, wordplay, soundplay, all kinds of stuff we won't go into that are connecting the two stories together. And the reference to the flood marks out a new beginning for the people of God. If you read the story of the flood, we talked about this when we went through Genesis in our neighborhood fellowships, you'll find that actually the story of the flood parallels in a crazy, remarkable, detailed way the story of creation. So in the flood, you have everything that takes place in creation is reversed and then redone. So the flood and creation are closely tied together. And now we find that Moses being placed in this ark because he is good has tied back to both creation and to the flood. On another note, the very water that was supposed to be the death of the child was used by God to bring deliverance. Furthermore, the word that's translated here as flags is the same word that's translated as red, as in the Red Sea. It's the word suf, where Pharaoh and his armies drowned. So the bodies of water were not the same place. There is a link being set up between the means that God's enemies attempted to use to destroy God's people and the means that God used to destroy those enemies. Moses was saved by Suf, being placed among the Suf, and Pharaoh's army was destroyed by being placed in the Yam Suf, the Sea of Suf. And what the Suf means in the Sea of Suf, we'll get to, though I won't tell you because I don't know and I don't think anyone else does. It's very tricky. But when we get to chapter 15, we'll talk about that. So coming back to Exodus 2 and verse 5, and the daughter of Pharaoh, not the only daughter that Pharaoh had. He had many wives. He probably had many daughters. But one of those daughters comes down to wash herself at the river, and her maidens walked along by the river's side to keep any prying eyes away, perhaps. And when she saw the ark among the flags, she sent her maid to fetch it. And when she had opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the babe wept. And she had compassion on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Pharaoh had despised the power of daughters, and now once again it was the daughters, this time the daughters of Egypt, who would thwart his evil plans. And as a side note, this is the only reference in Scripture to an infant weeping. Verse 7, then said his sister to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call to thee a nurse of the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for thee?" This girl is quick on her feet and very clever. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." And the maid went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said unto her, "Take this child away and nurse it for me, and I will give thee thy wages." And the woman took the child and nursed it. Now, in the ancient world, children were weaned about 3 years old. They nursed much, much longer than most people do in our day. And Moses' mother, thanks to Miriam's quick thinking and God's providence, would be paid to nurse her own son and to bring up her son in her own home. And you think about it, Moses' mother only had Moses for just a couple of years, just a tiny amount of time, 3 years, maybe 4 years at the most. And yet, more than 30 years later, Moses still knew who he was and what it meant to be one of the children of Israel. And you think of how much his mother must have poured into him during the short time that she had him. And it's something that's always inspired me and something that I would wish to emulate and wish I did wish to emulate in my own home, and an example that has been set for us of something we should do. And the child grew, and she brought him unto Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she called his name Moses, and she said, because I drew him out of the water. Now, I mentioned the significance of names a bit earlier. Remember how Pharaoh, in a previous paragraph, Pharaoh's not named, the midwives are named. So in this paragraph, Moses is the only person who's named. And that's significant because all Moses does is cry. He goes, wah, that's the only thing Moses does in this whole paragraph. So if that's all you had to go with, if everyone was named, you might lose sight of who the paragraph was really about. And so the only name is Moses' name, and it comes at the end of the paragraph, and that helps you to know this is a story not about Moses' mother, ultimately, not about Pharaoh's daughter, not about Moses' sister, but about Moses. It's a way of letting you know who the main subject, who the central character is. Why does God, here's a question for you, why does God seem to delight so much in using those despised by the world to bring deliverance to his people? Why does God delight in using those despised by the world to bring deliverance to his people? In this case, he is using the son of a Hebrew slave and the slave's sister. Why does God delight in the... And he's using all of these women also. He's using all of these women to thwart Pharaoh's mighty strength. He's using Hebrew slaves and Pharaoh's daughter, the ones that Pharaoh overlooked.
That he is the one doing it.
Absolutely. Anyone else? All right. Let's move on to verse 11. So in verses 1 through 10, we have Moses as a child. A neat little thing that's going on here. In the paragraph about the midwives, there are seven words that refer to the midwives. In the paragraph about Moses as a child, there are seven references to the Hebrew word yeled, which is the word for child. And then in the paragraph about Moses as a man, there are seven references to ish, the word for man. So there's kind of this thread of sort of key words in each of these paragraphs that helps tie the paragraph together and let you know what those paragraphs are about. It's a neat little detail. So in the first paragraph of chapter 2, we learned about Moses as a child. In the second paragraph, we learned about Moses as an adult. This story is Moses' attempt to rescue his people, his rejection by them, and his flight to Egypt is also found in Acts 7 and is referenced in Hebrews 11. So Exodus chapter 2 and verse 11. It came to pass in those days when Moses was grown that he went out to his brethren and looked on their burdens, and he spied an Egyptian smiting an Hebrew, one of his brethren. And he looked this way and that way, and when he saw that there was no man, he slew the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And the book of Acts tells us Moses was around 40 years old when these events took place. And yet though his mother only had him for a very short time, he still knew who his people were, and he still chose to identify with those people, as Hebrews 11 emphasizes, in his place in the Hall of Faith. Now, it's important to note that the word translated as smite, where he spied an Egyptian smiting in Hebrew in verse 11, and the word translated as slew in verse 12, where Moses slew the Egyptian, are exactly the same word in Hebrew. The Egyptian is striking the Hebrew, and Moses strikes the Egyptian. And because the same word is used, it's left ambiguous whether Moses, he looks around. And the text doesn't tell us, does he look around to see whether there's another deliverer? So you have a passage in Isaiah where it says that very similar language is used of God, that he looks to see, is there anyone who's going to save? And then God saves his people himself. So it's possible that Moses is looking around to see, is anyone going to stop this injustice? And then Moses decides, well, no one else is going to stop it, so I must stop it. That's possible. It's also possible that he doesn't want anyone to see what he's about to do. If he's looking to see that no one is overlooking him, that it's more likely that his intentions were perhaps actually to kill the Egyptians. So it's ambiguous whether the death of the Egyptian is intentional. That was what Moses was trying to do. He was trying to get rid of this oppressor, or whether it was accidental that he tried to stop him from beating the Hebrew and didn't know his own strength or didn't know what he was doing, and he ended up killing him unintentionally. What is clear is that while Moses' intentions were good, he wanted to stop injustice, his vigilante justice taking matters into his own hands only made the situation worse. So regardless of what was going through Moses' mind, which is left ambiguous, what is clear is that what he did nothing to deliver his people. No situation of oppression is ever so bad that it cannot be made worse by unjustified violence. No situation is ever so bad that it cannot be made worse by unjustified violence. A zeal for justice, as precious as that is, can be misdirected. And when it is misdirected, it can cause great harm. Verse 13, when he went out the second day, behold, two men of the Hebrews strove together, and he said to him that did the wrong, wherefore smitest thou thy fellow? And he said, who made thee a prince and a judge over us? Intendest thou to kill me as thou killedest the Egyptian? And Moses feared and said, surely this thing is known. Now when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses, but Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. So for a second time, Moses demonstrates a zeal for the oppressed. This is a consistent thing in Moses' life. And this is the story that Stephen picks up in Acts 7 to exemplify the scornful attitude of the Jewish leaders of his own day towards Jesus. And as Stephen tells the story, it was persecution by his fellow Israelite that caused Moses to flee from Egypt. So it appears that this other Jewish person who is oppressing his fellow Israelite is perhaps the one who informs Pharaoh of what Moses has done, causing him to have to flee Egypt. So at least some of the blame for Moses fleeing Egypt, I alluded to this briefly this morning, is laid at the feet not only of the Egyptians, but of a Jewish oppressor, one of Moses' own people. Verse 16, so Moses runs to Midian, he escapes for his life, and he sits down on a well. Now the priests of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. And the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. Now this is now the third time that Moses is delivering or attempting to deliver someone who is being oppressed. And we see that while his first efforts were unwise and misdirected and caused more harm than good, he doesn't kill any of the shepherds this time. He's learned how to deal with bullies without, you know, having to bury their bodies. So just get rid of them. So he delivers these girls from these oppressive shepherds. Now, there's something that's very interesting here. And then he helps them and he waters their flock. Now, there's a striking connection here. Now, Isaac meets his wife by a well. The servant meets his wife by a well. But in the story of Isaac, it is Rebekah, in the story of Isaac's wife, it's Rebekah who does the watering. But in the story of Jacob, it's Jacob who waters the flock for Rachel. So when Jacob first met Rachel, not only did he meet her at a well, but he also helped her by watering her father's flocks. And just as the references to the story of Noah, remember the ark, remember the reference to the creation, that helps to see the rescue of Moses as a new start for God's creation, so too also do the allusions to Jacob in this story set Moses up as a new father of his people. The name of Jacob was Israel. Israel was the one who was the father of his people, and now Moses is going to be a new father to his people, so he's following in Jacob's footsteps, delivering girls by a well and watering their flocks for them. Verse 18, when they come to rule their father, he said, how is it that you are come so soon today? And they said, an Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds, and also drew water enough for us and watered the flock. And he said unto his daughters, And where is he? Why is it that you've left the man? Call him. Get him over for dinner now. Now, Moses looked like an Egyptian, but Reuel had 7 daughters to find husbands for, and he was not allowed to let this hardworking, studly Egyptian guy get away from him. He was going to get him hitched to one of his daughters as quickly as possible. He's like, girls, you have messed this thing up. You let that guy get away from you. Go get him. And they did. And behold, what did happen? Verse 21, and Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses Zipporah, his daughter. 1 down, 6 to go. Verse 22, and she bare him a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, I have been a stranger in a strange land. So sure enough, Moses married one of his daughters, and then Moses gave his firstborn son a very significant name. We find this in Genesis 15, and God said unto Abraham, Abram, know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. And also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterward shall they come out with great substance. I have a quote from a commentator about Gershom, the name of Moses' son. The land is Egypt, not Midian. And Moses speaks of there, not here, as well as referring to the past. The fulfillment of the predicted slavery evokes the associated promise of liberation, so that the birth of the child may be seen as symbolic of the coming regeneration of downtrodden Israel. So Ger means stranger, and Shom means there. So Gershom's name means stranger there. And it's not completely clear, but when you look at it in the context of Genesis 15, it becomes reasonably clear that Moses is saying stranger there. He was a stranger, not necessarily in the land of Midian, but in the land of Egypt. And there's some different opinions on that, but I think that that is actually what is taking place. So I have a question on this paragraph. How can a misdirected zeal for justice end up causing even more harm, making things worse? What are some situations in which that could occur in our own day, where there's a zeal for justice that's good, but it's used in a way that makes things worse? Anyone have any ideas about that? Stephen?
Last year, when the black man was killed by the police officer, and then that whole thing on Capitol Hill.
Yeah. Riots can definitely make things worse, regardless of who's running them. I think another thing that that I always think about is with abortion, that early on in the anti-abortion movement, there was some very extreme things that were done that gave everyone who was fighting for life a very bad name and a very bad reputation. It's taken decades to work out from under. There was a very few individuals who bombed some abortion clinics, and it really took a long time to work out from that bad reputation. But there was undoubtedly a zeal and a willingness even to suffer to end the oppression of abortion, but it was so misdirected that it really was a black stain on the pro-life cause for many years and was very hard to recover from. What would be some other examples of how that could look like in our society or in our lives? Anyone else? Nate.
We had the riot at the Capitol.
Yep. Rioting is always destructive, no matter who's doing it or why they think it's justified. And another question, how could we use the danger of destructive zeal as an excuse for not caring at all? So it's pretty easy to see ways in which misguided zeal can be destructive, but sometimes we can use the misguided zeal of others as an excuse for simply turning a blind eye to something that needs to be addressed. What would be some ways in which that could happen? Sarah?
Not wanting to get lumped in with the people who are rioting and going about it the wrong way.
Yeah. That can be really hard. You don't want to be one of those people, and that's why destructive zeal is so destructive, is because there's lots of people who might have been able to do something helpful, but because of all the destruction, they are afraid to do so or maybe are hindered from doing so. Anyone else? Janine?
This kind of goes back to the last question and this question. When you are trying your best to witness to somebody
and you're doing it the right way. You're being their friend. You're trying to show the love of Christ to them and stuff like that. But then you've got another friend who has great zeal, and they're seeing what you're doing, but they want to hurry it up along, and they, like, shove the Bible down their throat. That would be the bad situation. And then there's those that are, like, I just don't want to shove the Bible down somebody's throat and just keep preaching at them all the time instead of, you know, loving them into Christ. And so I'm just not going to do it at all because I'll probably do it wrong.
That's a really good example. That's very good, very good. All right, moving on. Oh, sweetheart.
I remember in our Live Not By Lies discussion, we talked about how some may be called to a form of zeal, but we're not all called to the same level, but it can make us think like, well, I'm not going to do that really bold thing, so you kind of become passive.
Yeah. Because we recognize the true principle that we're not all called to do the same thing, we can feel like, well, I'm justified in doing no thing. Is that what you were getting at? Yeah, I thought that's a really good point to bring up as well. So verse 23, it came to pass in the process of time, the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage, and they cried, and their cry came up unto God by reason of the bondage. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob, and God looked upon the children of Israel, and God had respect unto them. And there's two things here, though it is not as clear in English translation. In Hebrew, four different terms are used for the suffering of the children of Israel. So there's four different Hebrew words that are used for their suffering. And then there's four different Hebrew verbs that explain God's response to that suffering. Now, in Hebrew grammar, it would have been totally acceptable for God to be mentioned once as the subject of those four verbs. But actually, God is mentioned four separate times. So you have four things that the children of Israel are suffering and four actions that God takes in response. And to emphasize that it is God that is taking that response, God is repeated as the subject with every one of those verbs. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is the phrase that the King James translates as God had respect unto them is literally, simply, God knew. The very same Hebrew word that's used in 1:8 to refer to Pharaoh's refusal to know Joseph. The ESV captures well the striking brevity of the Hebrew of verse 25, which contains only seven words in the whole Hebrew verse. It's a very brief, almost to the point of being cryptic. Verse 25 in the ESV, God saw the people of Israel and God knew. God knew is the last word of verse 25. And it ties back and beautifully wraps together this whole section. It starts with a Pharaoh who does not know, does not want to know. And it ends with a God who does know, in fact, who remembers his covenant. It's not like God had forgotten about them, but it's God is choosing to know, and in knowing, God is choosing to act. So the contest has now been set up between the Pharaoh who doesn't know. Now, of course, this Pharaoh dies, but this Pharaoh becomes a symbol for the second Pharaoh as well. So between those who are following the anti-creational agenda of Pharaoh and the Pharaoh that comes after this Pharaoh, the Pharaoh of the Exodus, follows right along with the first Pharaoh's policies. And so the contest has been set up between Pharaoh and between God. Pharaoh has servants who are obeying his commands to oppress the children of Israel. But who is going to obey God's commands? Who is going to be God's servant? And we find that out in the next section, which we will, Lord willing, come to next week. So any final questions before we wrap up? Any questions or comments? Brother Nate.
I don't know if you already answered this, but do you think Pharaoh had heard about the promise of the seed of the woman coming to crush the head of the serpent?
I don't know.
And I just wondered if that might have been part of his motivation to kill the seed of the woman. Kill the man.
Yeah, I'd probably see that as unlikely, but I think it's part of the story that we should see that as the conflict behind the conflict. Whether Pharaoh's aware of that or not, that's what's going on. So Pharaoh is a dragon. In fact, actually, in Isaiah, the Pharaohs are depicted as a dragon figure that's sloshing around in the Nile River. And so that's what's actually going on in spiritually, in reality, even if Pharaoh's not aware of it. I don't think he probably would have been. I suppose it's possible, since the Jews had been there for quite some time. But whether he's aware of it or not, that's what he's up against.
And the second one is, I never saw it as comical until you said so, that the he's trying to kill the boys, but the women are the ones that are subverting his plans. What I did always see as comical was what the Hebrew midwife said as their excuse. Like, nah, these Hebrew women, they're not like your Egyptian women. Like, the midwives are like disrespecting the Hebrew women. It didn't sound like you thought that was part of the joke.
Yeah, I think you're right. So I think it's quite possible that something really was taking place with the Hebrew women. Yeah. So I was sort of emphasizing that point, but they are dissing the Egyptian women. That is definitely something that's going on. So it's kind of like, yeah, they're not like those you know, slow Egyptian women. They're like, they go to have birth and their kids are already out. So they're like, you know, there's some other things with the language there. But so it definitely is a diss on Egyptian childbearing. But, yeah.
Typically, it could be just on him personally. Here he was in his first round trying to keep kids from coming to this world by forced labor. Now he's made the women so strong, they don't need a midwife anymore. Pump those babies out and get back to work, people.
That's interesting. That is interesting. That's quite, that is, I did not not think of that one. I think that's, yeah. April. Yes. Yes. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, through all of eternity, we'll be able to see more and more how much was at stake in situations that maybe we thought didn't matter, and how God was glorified, and just the thought of that, you know, the things we do matter in ways that we have no way of knowing, and all He calls us to do is to be faithful. Teresa.
I find it interesting that Pharaoh's daughter named Moses, and I wondered what was his name before that. Is there any reference from when he was born until he was given to Pharaoh's daughter?
No, but there is something very interesting about Moses' name. So there's two things that are going on. So first of all, Moses, like that is simply the Egyptian word for a son. But in Hebrew, now Pharaoh's daughter says Moses because I drew him out of the water. But there's a problem with her explanation, because drawn out of the water would require a passive participle, which would be like Mosui. I don't have it in front of me, like Masui. But Moses is an active participle, which means the one who does the drawing out. So Pharaoh's daughter's explanation is though, hey, I drew him out of the water. But actually, his name means someone who himself is doing the drawing out. And of course, that's what Moses will do. He will be used by God to draw the people of Israel out of Egypt. So it's kind of a play on words there with his name that I skipped over for the sake of time. And so there's actually some interesting things, like, did Pharaoh's daughter know Hebrew? Is that, you know, an explanation that Moses's family gave? Did they have sort of an accidental over, you know, not that it was accidental, but did they sort of unintentionally on their part give him the same name? Exactly what was going on there is hard to see, but his name is very significant. The exact way it's spelled is a joke, because she thinks he's the one that she drew out, but he's going to be the one that God's going to use to draw his people out. And there's some connections to Isaiah there too, but I don't have those at the tip of my memory. Sweetheart?
I want to touch back on the first question you asked before you started, when you asked if a survey of the semester or the year would be helpful. I think there was confusion on if you wanted input or if you wanted a raise of hands of who would find that helpful.
The latter. I wanted to raise his hands of who would be interested. So I already have a plan for the next year, but I'm interested in knowing who would want to know the plan. Okay, I was surprised. Like, no one raised their hand. I was like, I guess it just isn't interesting to people. Okay, that was more what I was thinking. So I'm not sure if I want to do the whole year or at least a semester, but we'll have something over the summer in the bulletin for what's going to be coming up, at least a semester and maybe for the year as well. All right. It is 7:30. Oh.
Like,
oh, I don't know. I'll have to figure it out. All right. Let us be dismissed.